When UK-based New Zealand writer Margaret Meyer visited a local museum in the town of Aldborough in Suffolk, it led her to uncover the story of a group of women accused of being witches and the men who hunted them. Margaret Meyer's debut novel, The Witching Tide, is inspired by what were England's deadliest witch hunts, the East Anglian, between 1645 and 1647. And her book tells the story of a mute midwife, healer and servant called Martha Halibut. Margaret Meyer joins me now. Hello.
Hi there, Kim.
Where are you? In Norwich.
That's right. I'm in Norwich, Norfolk, which is part of East Anglia.
Tell me what you saw in the museum in Aldborough.
What I saw was just two panels of information about the witch hunt and about the fact that the witch hunt had come to Aldborough in 1645. And leading it was one of two witch hunters. His name was Matthew Hopkins. And over the course of the witch hunt, Matthew Hopkins paid three visits to Aldborough. But the 1645 visit was the deadliest one. He rode into town at the beginning of the week. And when he rode out of Aldborough at the end of the week, seven women were hanging from the gallows. And that was mainly what I discovered in the museum. I'd already known about the witch hunts, but not in any detail. So that visit to the museum that day really coloured in for me what had just been facts and history books up until that point.
Your character, Silas Makepeace, the witch finder general, is modelled, I understand it, on Matthew Hopkins. What motivated Matthew Hopkins? I mean, we did an interview on this programme a few weeks ago about conditions in the world or in a society which are conducive to a kind of mass hysteria or anxiety. Is that what we're seeing? This is at the time of the Civil War in England, of course.
Yes, that's right. I think mass hysteria might not be quite accurate. I think that this particular witch hunt unfolded at a time of tremendous uncertainty and upheaval in England. As you said, the Civil War was raging. King Charles I's troops were stationed towards Huntingdon, so in the west of East Anglia. And that meant that a lot of men had gone away to fight on one side or the other. It also meant that there were huge shortages of food because the armies had requisitioned a lot of it. And there'd also been a very harsh winter, lots of crops failures. The whole justice system had gone into abeyance because of the Civil War. So that meant that courts weren't sitting. And that in turn meant that it proved harder to query the witch hunt or even stop it once it got underway. And then add to that extreme weather events, East Anglia's relative isolation from London particularly. There were wave after wave of migrants and Irish refugees coming into East Anglia because of potato famines in Ireland. So we've got the makings of a perfect storm, really. And into that appeared these two witch hunters, John Stern and Matthew Hopkins. And I really think those were the conditions that enabled them to get away with what they did for as long as they did.
So what motivated them? I mean, were they being paid?
Yes, they were. They were charging fees for their services.
To whom?
So if you had a witch problem in your town, you would send for one of the witch finders and they would charge you a fee to help you solve your problem. So it was a fee direct to the witch finder, and then there were all the additional costs. So you had to pay for the witch finder's accommodation. He might come to town with one of his search mistresses. She would need food and board. The jailers had to be paid. The people who supplied the food to the accused had to be paid, and so on and so on. So it was a very, very costly business. But there's no doubt that Matthew Hopkins, in particular, who was, I think, the more entrepreneurial of the two, did make quite a tidy sum from offering his services.
But do you think he, I mean, is it possible to say whether he genuinely believed in the existence of witches who needed to be eradicated?
It's impossible to say, but my guess would be probably. And I think it's very likely true of his companion John Stern, who was the person who initiated the witch hunt in the first place. I think they would have believed that they were doing the right thing, that this was a very real problem, a very dangerous problem, and that needed action, and that they were two people who had studied demonology. They looked at accounts of witch hunts and witch trials in the past, in recent history, and in the centuries preceding 1645. And quite quickly, they built up a kind of witch finding methodology, which was known about, and that's what they would have offered to the towns and villages that sought their help. So
We'll
yes, I think they did believe in what they were doing.
talk about that methodology in a moment, but why did you demur at the notion of it being mass hysteria?
I'm wary of that term because it's often used in a way
Against
that's
women.
demeaning to women.
Yep.
Yeah, demeaning to women. And I think it's possibly, in any case, I think it's possibly an overstatement. I think what there was a great deal of was fear, huge uncertainty, and huge suspicion of anything outside the status quo. And at times, I think that did tip over into hysteria, but I think the day-to-day picture was just more, one more of people being very watchful and very fearful of anything going wrong next.
When it comes to methodology of identifying witches, which is a handy trick to have up your sleeve at all times, what we're familiar with is the idea that, the catch 22, they were thrown into a pond, and if they sank and drowned, they were innocent. Did that actually happen?
Yes, it did. By the time this particular witch hunt was happening, it was actually illegal to what was called swim a witch, but people did it anyway. I've read a few stories of women being swum. That was the euphemism that was used, but it was actually illegal, and as this witch hunt unfolded, 1645 to 7, where there were swimmings, they were quite often denounced from pulpits and increasingly by members of parliament. But yes, they did happen.
However, the methods that they did use more often were pricking, for example, and your main character, Martha Halibred, was a pricker, which was what?
Pricker was a woman, usually a midwife, so somebody who knew about women's bodies, who was hired by one of the witch hunters to carry out very invasive body searches of accused women. They were looking for what they thought were witches' marks, which could be any strange piece of skin, any mole, any freckle, a birthmark, a skin tag, a wart, anything. They thought these indicated that you'd either been marked by the devil, or they were the marks left behind when you had suckled devil's familiars, when you had suckled your imps. And so you would be stripped naked, and at least one search woman would go over your entire body, and I really mean from the crown of your head to the soles of your feet and in between your toes, looking for marks. And if they found any kind of mark at all, they would prick it with a needle or a bodkin or a lancet, as a way of checking out what that mark was. And the lore about pricking was that if a mark was pricked and it didn't bleed, then it was pretty conclusive evidence that that mark was suspicious, which in turn was pretty conclusive evidence that you had covenanted with the devil and that you were a witch.
What were the other methods used?
So the other method, the main method, would come before the pricking. So a suspected witch would be, first of all, arrested, and the bailiffs would go to her house
Do we know
and
why?
arrest her.
I mean, why would there have to be a reason given for why she was arrested? What was the usual trigger for that?
The usual triggers were neighbor turning against neighbor, really. So it would be examples, very common examples at that time would be an unusual woman, usually someone who is a bit on the margins, for one reason or another. Maybe she was a spinster, maybe she was extremely poor, maybe she was a bit strange. Maybe she was just very, very elderly, but she would usually be accused of some misdeed that had affected other people in the locality. So a very common thing would be that an elderly woman, let's say she was destitute, very, very hungry, might go to the village and knock on someone's door and ask for food. And very likely she'd be declined because food was very scarce. And so the woman of that household turning her down would probably not have enough food herself. So she would turn this old woman away. And maybe that elderly woman would be angry about that and say a few angry words. And then, let's say a couple of days later, one of the children in that household suddenly falls very, very sick. Or some other happening befalls that household. Animals get sick, people are thrown from horses, the chimney suddenly catches fire. And so very commonly then those events would be linked to the fact that, oh, that very old woman came to the house asking for bread, and when she was turned away, she left and put a curse on us, or she must have summoned her imps to bring disaster on our heads. So that pattern was very, very common. It was people putting two and two together and getting five.
And so an individual would be arrested and effectively tortured.
Yes. They would be, first of all, walked up and down day and night for days and nights on end, two, three, four days and nights with no sleep. They were not allowed sleep. They were generally denied food. So they would be walked to the point of exhaustion. And oftentimes women did confess at that point, unsurprisingly. But if she didn't confess, or if they just wanted further evidence, that's very likely when the prickers would be deployed. There would usually be at least There were usually more than one pricker. So there might be two or three prickers who would then come in and carry out this searching and pricking of that of that woman. And then any testimony she gave, any statements she made would be written down and used as evidence against her in the subsequent court hearing.
And Martha herself comes to suspect that there may well be witches, even though we have come to regard her as a kind of a touchstone of sensibleness.
Martha, that's right. Martha finds herself between a rock and a hard place. So, on the one hand, she knows a number of the women who've been accused, and some of them she knows very well. So, another servant in the same household, for example, right at the beginning of the book, is arrested, charged with of having committed witchcraft, and carted off to jail. And then other women from the village are similarly thrown into jail. So Martha's very torn. On the one hand, she knows these women. She can't quite believe that they've done what they're accused of doing. But she herself is not immune from the suspicion and the fear that's gripped the village. And she's lived in this village her whole life, born and bred. She's very passionate about this place where she lives. She's very loyal to the household in which she serves. She doesn't want anything to change. She doesn't want any misfortune to befall the village. So one of her main motivations is just to maintain the status quo, which for her has been very, very peaceful up until this point. She wants that to continue. And so these two tensions collide very spectacularly when ultimately she herself is roped in to the witch hunt and is compelled against her will to become a search woman and to get involved in pricking women she's counted as friends up until now.
Martha is mute because she has something wrong with her throat, which is variously described, but most often as a kind of a dark snake. Is
Yes.
this a metaphor? What are you saying here?
Yes, it is a metaphor. It's also very real to the character. So her muteness was a surprise even to me. And I kind of stumbled on it in the early drafts when I was getting to know Martha as a character. And I sat down one day to write a dialogue scene involving Martha and some of the other villagers, and suddenly discovered that whenever it came for Martha's turn to say something, I couldn't actually write it. And this really stopped me in my tracks for several months. I was grappling with this problem and I was becoming quite worried. How was I going to finish a novel with a protagonist who couldn't talk? And how was I going to write the dialogue scenes? And very slowly, it dawned on me that she wasn't talking because she couldn't talk. And then a bit later on, it became apparent that she has this obstruction in her throat, which, as you say, she refers to it as the worm, a kind of worm in her throat. It's a blockage in her throat. And that's come about from childhood trauma, which eventually we discover in the book. So it is a real physical impediment on one level. And on another level, you're right. It is a metaphor. It's a metaphor for the silencing of these women and the ways in which women have been rendered silent through history. And witch hunts are very clear and prime examples of this. Doing the research for the book, I did look at records of witch trials, and sometimes the accounts of the accused women are recorded, and sometimes they're not, even though they must have spoken. And for me, that became a really major theme in the book and a really major reason for why I wanted to write the book. And a big driver of needing to finish the book was to make this point to draw people's attention to the way women were silenced in this witch hunt and in all witch hunts, in fact. And there are parallels, obviously, with the present day in that as well.
There's a, I mean, witches are a thing at the moment. And not only in literature, there's somebody's drawn my attention to an exhibition at the Gus Fisher Gallery in Auckland, which is called She Could Lie on Her Back and Sink. And it's about artistic responses to the figure of the witch. In both Aotearoa and European lineages. I'm reading from its website now. And it's framed through an intersectional feminist lens where wise women and customary knowledge holders are revered. But then, of course, as you point out, the tables can turn quite quickly, as they did with Martha. Why do you think witches? This seems like an obvious question, but I'll get you to answer it. Why do you think witches are so prominent right now?
I personally think one of the reasons they're so prominent right now is partly in response to a fairly alarming and very visible reduction and eroding of women's rights that's going on right around the world. It's true that certainly in publishing, certainly in the UK, witch lit, so-called, is definitely having a moment. There's no doubt about that. But even before that publishing phenomenon, I think the figure of the witch was rising to prominence in our collective psyches. I think the figure of the witch, on a psychological level, Carl Jung might say that the witch represents the shadow side of the human psyche. I think that's true, and I also think on a collective level, perhaps a more political level, the witch is obviously a figure of subversion. She occupies a very unique position, on the one hand, often on the margins of society, and yet with this amazing ability to have influence for good or bad in what goes on in society, and what goes on in culture, and what goes on in actual villages. And at the same time, the witch has always been an affront to patriarchy. So when we come to something like this particular witch hunt, 17th century witch hunt, all of those energies are running. The difference then was there was a very firm, concrete belief in the existence of witches. I think that's maybe different, certainly in the first world countries today, we might take a different attitude. But nevertheless, the archetype of the witch, the figure of the witch, the symbol of the witch, still holds that power. And that power and that influence has its roots, right back in earliest human history.
I should say that the title of that exhibition at the Gus Fisher Gallery, She Could Lie on Her Back and Sink, is a quote from a short story by Pip Adam. She was underwater now, just like her grandmother, just like her grandmother's grandmother. She could lie on her back and sink. It's interesting, isn't it? The resonance. Did you have to work very hard to make the 17th century story have resonance for now, do you think?
No, I didn't actually. Because while I was writing it, things were happening in the UK that had resonance, that had parallels, and things were happening around the world.
What was happening in the UK?
Well, one of the really key events for me, and it had a huge impact in the UK, was the murder of Sarah Everard during one of the lockdowns here in the UK. Sarah Everard was a young woman in her early 30s who was walking home one evening, and she was stopped by a serving policeman who falsely accused her of having breached lockdown regulations and got her into his car and drove off with her and subsequently raped and then murdered her. So this is just a huge shock, reverberated right around the UK. And then not long after that, there was a vigil held for Sarah by a group of women who tried very, very hard to work with the police to hold this vigil socially distanced, observing all the requirements of lockdown. And the police came and very, very forcefully, some would say using unnecessary force, crushed that vigil and all the subsequent protests. So that's just one example of what we've just been talking about: women being attacked, women losing their lives, other women trying to speak up against that, sounding our voices against that, and being pretty swiftly silenced. So that to me was this whole story in playing out again, I guess. And then, on a more global scale, for example, the Taliban coming back into power in Afghanistan, and in very short order, women are not allowed out of their houses unless they're accompanied by male relatives. Now they're not allowed to go to school. So you don't have to look far to see the parallels. And that's why, in the writing of the book, I didn't have to work particularly hard for those parallels.
Just a bit of a fact check. It's very difficult to know, I imagine, some of the details about the story, the witch hunt in East Anglia. But I've read three figures of how many women died. 100, 200, 300. Obviously, 100 is a lot, but that seems a bit vague. Why? Why so vague? Did they not keep records?
Not in all cases, they didn't keep records. So we just go back to the Alba example, which is the village that inspired my engagement with this story. In Alba, the victims were counted. There were seven of them, but they weren't named. Only two of the seven were named, and for some reason, the other five weren't named. So that's just an indication of the haphazard nature of the record keeping at that time. So that's why there's no definitive figure. I read something last year that said it was suggesting that perhaps only 12 women had lost their lives. This year, earlier this year, I read a more recent publication that put the figure up closer to 200. But the answer is we can't know for sure.
What happened to them after they were dead?
They were usually taken away and buried in unmarked graves outside the town or village, usually in wasteland or scrap, wasteland. They were just thrown into unmarked graves. So they were.
This is a two-book deal for you. Is the next book going to cover the same kind of area?
The next book is set in the same village, village of Cleftwater, and it's a kind of sequel to this one. It will cover the stories of three more women in different periods of history, one before 1645 and the other two, one in the 18th century, one around about the time of the First World War. And they all live in Cleft Water, and they all come across this witching doll that features in The Witching Tide, the wax poppet. One after another, they all come across the poppet. And so the next book is looking at their stories about what happens each time the poppet falls into a different woman's hands.
Was that what this kind of wax doll was called, a poppet?
Yes, a poppet could be, it usually was a doll or a little figurine, not necessarily made of wax, but they were little figurines that reputedly witches kept. They're often in the likeness of a particular person. And sometimes the witch would needle that figurine or damage the doll in some way. And this was thought to be a kind of sympathetic magic, so that if the doll was perhaps, I don't know, pricked in the arm, then the real person might then experience something wrong in their arm. So that was what poppets were.
It's very good to talk to you. Thank you, Margaret Meyer, whose debut novel, she has done a considerable amount of writing, and she did her MA a couple of years ago in prose fiction at the University of East Anglia. But this is her first novel, and it's called The Witching Tide.